We'll have a very good day.
Today is Thursday, the 29th of July, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Pakistan's prime minister says the withdrawal of U.S. troops in Afghanistan eliminates any power over bringing the two warring sides together for peace.
Quite frequently that this accelerated drawdown with no progress in peace talks between the warring sides will undermine the leverage of Pakistan over the Taliban.
Plus, the food crisis in Yemen continues to worsen. We'll have these stories and more next. Pakistan's prime minister says that America's accelerated troop exit from Afghanistan has left Washington with no bargaining power for arranging a peace deal between warring Afghans. Joining us from Islamabad, Pakistan, is Ayaz Ghul. Ayaz, can you kind of explain what prompted the prime minister's comments on Wednesday?
Well, actually, when the February 2020 agreement was signed between Washington and the Taliban, there were expectations that the deadline that was set in that agreement of May 1st, 2021, that by that time there would be progress in the peace negotiations between the Taliban and the Afghan government, and the drawdown would then take place at a time when there is progress also in the peace negotiations. But what we saw was that there was absolutely no progress in the intra-Afghan negotiations. But at the same time, when Biden administration took charge, obviously the drawdown was accelerated. And that is what, you know, Pakistan has been pointing out quite frequently, that this accelerated drawdown with no progress in peace talks between the warring sides will undermine the leverage of Pakistan over the Taliban and even the United States over the warring sides in Afghanistan. And that's what Imran Khan, the prime minister of Pakistan, was actually referring to, that now that most of the international troops are almost out of Afghanistan, it is very difficult for any outsider actor to convince either the Taliban or the Afghan government to really demonstrate some progress in the peace negotiations.
Ayaz, let's talk about that troop withdrawal for just a second. The Trump administration negotiated a deal with the Taliban to withdraw U.S. troops by May of this year. And when the Biden administration came into office, they said that that target would not be hit, but did say that an unconditional withdrawal would be completed by September 11th. Now, either way, U.S. troops were scheduled to depart Afghanistan. So can you kind of explain more what's behind Prime Minister Khan's comments?
That's right. The way the intra-Afghan negotiations began last September in Doha, there were high hopes that the two sides will come to some kind of an arrangement that would lead to some ceasefire in Afghanistan, and while the drawdown would be in progress. But unfortunately, you know, the very fact that the peace negotiations were supposed to start just 10 days after the United States signed the agreement with the Taliban in February last year, but those negotiations started like with a 6-month delay. And that delay plus a few more months was not enough time to for both the warring sides to really reach at some kind of an arrangement. And that lack of progress in the negotiations actually gave the Taliban a better position to intensify its attacks against Afghan security forces and capture more territory. The question that you have asked, that the troops would have been gone by May 1st of this year, according to the original agreement, everything was tied to the progress in intra-Afghan negotiations. But all those expectations and conditions were not met. And when President Biden said that it's enough and it's time for the United States to leave Afghanistan because the counterterrorism mission has almost been accomplished, and it is for the Afghans now to rebuild their country and agree on a political setup to run their country. Despite requests and latest studies that the drawdown of the American forces should slow down to give more time to the negotiations so that there can be some kind of a peace deal. Nothing has happened, but the drawdown continues, and by end of next month, all the American forces will be out. What will happen then? That is a very difficult situation, and that is what Prime Minister Imran Khan was referring to, that now the Taliban are looking at the current situation on the battlefield with all these dozens of districts that they've captured, that they have almost won the war against the United States. And it will now not be possible now even for Pakistan to use its leverage. Whether Imran Khan is telling the truth or not, it is difficult to ascertain. But he seemed frustrated in this interview that he gave to PBS NewsHour, where he said that currently, in his words, it's a messed up situation in Afghanistan.
I ask one last question. The UN assistance mission in Afghanistan said that if the Taliban does not meet with the government of Ashraf Ghani to continue those talks and hammer out a ceasefire and peace deal, the Taliban is going to lose international legitimacy. But that remark came on the same day that Taliban officials were in Beijing meeting with Chinese officials. So what's going on?
Well, this is absolutely right. Where the UN mission chief in Kabul made this speech today, underscoring the fact that if the Taliban try to militarily take control of Afghanistan, then obviously the global community will not accept it. And that has been the position of the regional countries and the United States. But at the same time, yes, you're right. It was quite a situation today that we saw the Taliban leaders were given a very warm welcome in Beijing. And Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi himself received the Taliban delegation. And for the first time, we saw the Chinese released video footages of those meetings, those handshake with Taliban leaders, and also images of that meeting. So it seems that China is really trying to grab the vacuum that is being created because of the withdrawal of the United States and NATO allies from Afghanistan, and China is trying to step in. There must be some kind of a mediator which is able to convince both the parties that it is time to end this long war, because it has really prevented the entire region from economically progressing. And China has this ambition of extending its Belt and Road Initiative, this infrastructure project of President Xi, to Central Asia through Afghanistan.
Ayaz Gul reports from Islamabad, Pakistan. The World Food Program warns Yemen's already alarming hunger crisis is worsening due to ongoing conflict and a rapidly declining economy that are sending food prices soaring. Lisa Schlein is up next.
Around 21 million people in Yemen need humanitarian assistance. This out of a population of just over 29 million. The United Nations, which considers Yemen the largest humanitarian crisis in the world, reports 16.2 million people are extremely short of food and suffering from acute hunger. Tobias Flamig is World Food Program Head of Research, Assessment, and Monitoring in Yemen. Speaking on a video link from the capital, Sana'a, he says people are resorting to desperate measures to survive. He says skyrocketing prices have made food unaffordable for millions of people. He says this is forcing many people to cut their food intake and eat only one meal a day.
A WFP team recently visited a village where families were resorting to eating leaves to survive. Traveling for work to reach markets or even seek medical care is almost impossible, because the cost of fuel is too high. Hunger leaves people acutely vulnerable to the various public health risks facing the country, including COVID-19, cholera, dengue, and malaria.
The UN Children's Fund projects nearly 2.3 million children under age 5 will suffer from acute malnutrition in Yemen this year. Of these, it warns, some 400,000 children suffering from severe acute malnutrition could die if they do not receive urgent treatment. The World Food Program estimates more than 5 million people in Yemen are on the brink of famine. Fleming says WFP has not yet declared a famine because specific evidence of food security, malnutrition, and mortality must be collected. This, he says, is difficult to do in a conflict zone.
The international community must not wait for such a classification in Yemen to act. People do not start dying when a declaration of famine is made. It is only their deaths that trigger a declaration.
WFP provides emergency food assistance to nearly 13 million people every month. The agency has increased food aid in all famine risk areas since the start of the year, as additional funds have become available. However, money remains in short supply. Consequently, cuts have had to be made. So 3 million beneficiaries are receiving food rations on alternate months instead of monthly. WFP requires $1.9 billion to run its humanitarian operation this year. It is $900 million short of this mark and is appealing to the international community to close this gap. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Myanmar's military coup has devastated the country's media. A new report finds at least 32 journalists are currently detained. VOA's Jesusumi Oni has more on the report just released by a press freedom group.
A humanitarian crisis for the media. That's how one press freedom organization is describing the Myanmar military crackdown on journalists. At least 32 are currently detained, the New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists says. The figure is a massive spike compared with the group's December global census of jailed media, when Myanmar accounted for only one case.
This is a worse situation than in China. This is a worse situation than in Turkey. This is a worse situation than Iran. This is a global press freedom crisis on a scale, frankly, I haven't seen in Southeast Asia in all my years of covering press freedom.
Myanmar's military faced some arrests under the civilian government of Aung San Suu Kyi, but nothing on the scale seen since the military seized power in February and arrested the pro-democracy leaders. Broadcast licenses were revoked and journalists were detained, often under incitement or false news charges. Many have fled to neighboring countries to avoid arrest.
Since the February 1 military coup, we've seen an extraordinary deterioration in the press freedom conditions there. And in just looking at the jailing of journalists alone, it seems pretty clear that the Hunter regime is aiming to eliminate the free press altogether.
Among those detained is American journalist Danny Fenster, who has been held for over 65 days and denied medical attention for the coronavirus. Fenster is one of four foreign journalists who have been arrested. A move, Crispin says, sends a chilling message.
That sends a pretty strong signal to all foreign media that if you do send your representatives into the country, they could face similar treatment.
Myanmar has freed some journalists and protesters, but for those still detained, conditions are dire, with reports of torture and overcrowding. American journalist Nathan Monk says he was beaten and abused before finally being freed and deported. Meanwhile, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin in Singapore Tuesday called for the release of those detained, saying the refusal of Myanmar's military to respect rights is flatly unacceptable. Myanmar's military council has not directly responded to VOA queries on the treatment of detainees, but a spokesperson said the questioning of suspects is in accordance with the rules and regulations. The future of democracy is at stake, Meng says.
People are dying out there every day. There is the fight to protect for democracy and human rights. So I would like to, tell the international community, take the side right now. Take the side for humanity. We are walking for, we are fighting for humanity.
Myanmar's junta should free all detained journalists and end its censorship and harassment of the media, says the Committee to Protect Journalists. The rights group is calling on the international community to review sanctions and support those fleeing the repression. For Witruta Dundee in Bangkok, Jason Semenyoni, VOA News.
In an Associated Press interview, Neil Ziering, the technical director for the U.S. National Security Agency's Cybersecurity Directorate, gives just a few tips on how to better protect your phone from hackers. AP reporter Ed Donahue has the story.
The NSA issued a best practices guide for mobile device security. Its cybersecurity technical director, Neil Ziering, says one is very simple. He has his smartphone set up to automatically restart every night.
Your phone knows where it is on the earth, and it will, under many circumstances, share that information with external parties.
Ziering says rebooting won't always work. Also, keep track of your apps.
When you're done with one, you're not going to use it anymore. Uninstall it, because by doing that, you keep your attack surface more bounded.
The NSA has even simpler advice to really make sure hackers aren't secretly recording off your smartphone. Don't carry it with you. I'm Ed Donahue.
Lithuanian Prime Minister Ingrida Simonetė has announced that her government will create an additional physical barrier separating Lithuania and Belarus to stop migrants from entering the country. Anna Rice narrates this story from the Lithuanian-Belarus border.
Lithuania is seeing a sharp increase in the number of illegal migrants crossing the border, over 1,300 in the first half of 2021, compared to just 80 in 2020.
We are heading to one of the least protected parts of the Belarus-Lithuania border that illegal migrants use most often to get into Lithuania. There used to be a checkpoint there, but because of COVID, it's been closed for a year and a half. There are at least still fences and cameras there, while the rest of the border has either small fences or a trail.
Every day, Lithuanian border guards stop dozens of illegal migrants here, mostly from Africa and the Middle East, as they try to get into Lithuania from Belarus.
I guess they're being brought here. You can see the grass is flattened on the Belarus side, probably from vehicles. We don't always stop them at the border. Sometimes they manage to get deeper into the country, but only a few kilometers. They don't get far.
Today, over 2,000 refugees live in makeshift camps in Lithuania, and the stream of migrants is not slowing down.
We have come from Belarus. I had no choice. My country is at war, and I wanted to go somewhere that is better, safer for me, where I can live in peace. Any country, maybe Germany.
Lithuanians living near the border are in a difficult situation. Some oppose the tent camps. Others are helping authorities deal with the unexpected influx.
It was a surprise for all of us, for our village, for the authorities, for all of Lithuania. Many people are trying to help. For example, refugees do not drink tap water, and we all here in the village do, so we have to bring them water from the spring.
Lithuania's defense minister, Arvydas Anušauskas, went to the border with Belarus to supervise the construction of a barbed wire fence. He said the Lithuanian military will do what it can to help.
In an extreme situation, the military can be summoned to offer help to our municipal and state institutions. This is the situation we have found ourselves in now. Previously, we already helped with logistics and constructed a tent camp. But we can provide more help, and we will do it.
In addition to the tent cities, a small number of migrants are housed in empty hotels. They are given food and other essentials until their asylum hearings. For Vladislav Andreev on the Belarus-Lithuania border, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Belarus opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya met with U.S. President Joe Biden Wednesday at the White House to discuss democracy and human rights in the former Soviet Republic. Tikhanovskaya called the meeting very warm and said that she felt that the U.S. stands with Belarus. During her time in Washington, she also met with the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. The The U.S. Treasury Department on Wednesday announced sanctions on 8 Syrian prisons run by President Bashar al-Assad's intelligence agencies, citing human rights abuses against political prisoners and other detainees. The department also sanctioned 5 senior Syrian government officials who control these detention centers. The Treasury Department also imposed sanctions on a Syrian armed group called Ahrar al-Sharqiyya and 2 of its leaders for abuses against civilians. Haiti's new prime minister pledged to hold elections as soon as possible during his first press conference. Ariel Henry called on the government to not only hold free and fair elections, but to do so safely and with a large voter turnout. In order to accomplish this, he stressed the need for adequate security. Henry also stressed the importance of reconciliation and unity. California and Nevada governors called for more federal assistance as they toured areas blackened by wildfires. Many fires remain ablaze, including Oregon's Blue Lake Fire, which has burned over 160 homes. Rain and cooler weather has helped fight the fires. The hotter and drier weather is scheduled to return. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Riots across South Africa this month exposed long-simmering anger over inequality and insecurity in the country. That, according to analysts, is an issue South Africa has not been able to overcome despite nearly 3 decades of democracy since the end of apartheid. Linda Givtash takes it from here.
Muhammad Ali Rondera watched helplessly from outside his electronic shop at a strip mall in Soweto as determined looters broke through its heavy metal gate. In a matter of hours, his livelihood of the past 7 years disappeared. Neighboring shops were also emptied before the one-story building was torched. Nationwide, losses from the unrest that overwhelmed police, destroyed infrastructure, and halted local economies are estimated in the billions of dollars. Small business owners like Muhammad Ali Rondera in Soweto are left asking authorities why.
I'm really disappointed this government, why the government can't open up their hands and do this targeting these people who are doing this nonsense thing. Because not only my shop, there's a million of people, they lost the business.
Experts say the riots were an eruption of frustrations that have long been simmering among South Africans. Extreme inequality has persisted since the ruling party, the African National Congress, was first elected in 1994. Nelson Mandela University's Ngwe Ndlovu says although it brought freedom to the nation, the ANC has since failed to deliver for the poorest.
But we're seeing now, post-1994, we have a different governance with a different voice, but the conditions are pretty much more or less the same. And then people are angry, people are hungry, and they want to take out this frustration.
President Cyril Ramaphosa announced earlier this week the return of a social grant for those who lost their jobs during COVID-19 lockdowns. Uninsured business owners like Rondera can also expect funding. But Johannesburg-based international relations expert Lisa Jernberg says the response has yet to restore public confidence in the state.
So there is some frustration that everything moves too slowly and that, you know, we hear lots of wonderful promises, but if you're not actually going to carry them through, then what's the point?
Divisions between the Big Ten party are also festering, while allegations of corruption under former President Jacob Zuma's administration mount. But voters are left with few alternatives. Jernberg said opposition parties fail to attract broad support by being too radical or appealing to old racial and ethnic ties. And yet, Jernberg says the unrest may have also revealed the strengths of the country's democracy.
The Constitutional Court held firm. The different people in civil society and the institutions came out in support of the Constitutional Court. And despite the unrest, President Zuma remains in prison, which has to be seen as a triumph for the rule of law.
The country is now closely watching how the law is being enforced on those involved in the riots. More than 2,500 people have been arrested, 6 of whom face charges for inciting violence. The government has said more arrests are expected. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
A COVID-19 lockdown in Sydney, Australia is being extended by a month as a surge in cases caused by the Delta variant continues. Phil Mercer has that story.
More than 2,500 infections have been detected since the latest COVID-19 outbreak began in Sydney in June. Australia's biggest city has been under its strictest lockdown since June 26, and it will now continue until at least August 28. The measures are being extended because infections are increasing, but have been met with resistance. On July 24, 3,500 anti-lockdown protesters rallied against the lockdown measures in Sydney. There were clashes with police and at least 57 people were arrested. State authorities in New South Wales on Wednesday said 177 new cases of the Delta variant had been diagnosed in the past 24 hours. At least 46 were infectious while out in the community, and the others were self-isolating. Residents in eight large districts in Sydney are banned from leaving their local area for work unless they have jobs in healthcare, elder care, or other critical sectors. Mandatory testing is in force. Officials have also ordered a new push to increase low rates of vaccinations. Only about 17% of Australians are fully inoculated. There has been hesitancy over the AstraZeneca vaccine because of concerns over side effects, although the manufacturer has denied any link to rare blood clots. Supplies of the Pfizer vaccine are limited. New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian says vaccines are a key defence against the virus and urged for people to do their part.
Delta is different to any other strain of COVID that we've seen. Our state's been incredibly successful in dealing with every other strain of COVID, but Delta is different. The one positive that we do have is that the vaccine is working. People with the vaccine are staying out of hospital, they're spreading it less than others, and we know it's an important protection. Please come forward and get vaccinated.
Some pandemic restrictions in Sydney and its surrounding regions are easing. Starting Saturday, construction in unoccupied buildings will be allowed. In 2 weeks, students in their final year of high school will go back to in-person learning. So-called rapid antigen testing, which are on-the-spot screening tests delivering results within minutes, will also be introduced to try to prevent the spread of COVID-19 outbreaks in schools. All other students will be taught at home. Lockdowns in the states of Victoria and South Australia were lifted this week after small clusters of COVID-19 cases were contained. Australia has reported more than 33,200 coronavirus cases since the pandemic began, and 922 people have died, according to the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Centre. Australia has implemented strict lockdowns, mass testing, contact tracing, and the closing of its international borders as part of the country's policy to curb further spread of the virus. International borders authorities say aren't expected to fully reopen until well into next year. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
In India, torrential monsoon rains in the west of the country have triggered floods and killed about 200 people. Experts link the increasingly erratic monsoons to climate change and warn that this poses a threat to the lives and livelihoods of millions of people. Anjana Pasricha rounds us out.
After torrential monsoon rains buried villages under landslides and flooded towns in India's western Maharashtra state, the region is coping with the aftermath. Homes reduced to rubble and inundated farmlands. Rescue teams have waded through debris and swirling waters to evacuate stranded people. It was too late for about 200 people who died. Much of the destruction occurred in districts along the west coast, a region that witnessed similar havoc 2 years ago. Climate experts link the rising incidence of such ferocious rainfall to global warming, which has affected the oceans where the monsoon winds originate.
The warming of the Arabian Sea and the Western Indian Ocean is bringing up a lot of heat into the atmosphere and also moisture, which is resulting in large-scale fluctuations in the monsoon winds. So though the monsoon winds are weak, occasionally there are episodes when they are very strong and releasing all of the moisture in a short time.
India's agriculture, which sustains more than half the country, is heavily dependent on the monsoon season. Minimizing the impact on struggling communities worst hit by such disasters should be prioritized, say experts. The recent flooding came 2 months after a cyclone lashed the West Coast. Until that happens, experts warn millions may face the onslaught of such destruction. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
And this has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. Just do so by visiting voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.